Anthony LaTorre is author of Talk Shows, published by Switchback Books in 2007, and Acufenos, a collection of poems in Spanish, published in Mexico City by Taller Editorial. She is co-author of the artist book, Appendices, Illustrations, and Notes, which you can read on UbuWeb. She is translator and editor of a volume of selected poems by Gerardo Denis, one of Mexico's leading exponents of neo-Baroque writing. She co-edited the anthology, Reversible Monuments, Contemporary Mexican Poetry, and is poetry editor of the Brooklyn Rail. Mary Jo Bang writes about Monica de la Torre, saying, "No one writes like Monica de la Torre. Many use some of the same techniques, the much-loved and now over-famous Ashberian non-sequitur, for example. But even so, she has a subtle and disarming way of tying her dissimilars together. In her poems, we encounter odd characters who meet in David Lynch-like accidental fashion. Small, bizarre incidents coalesce into a sign of our own mirrored, uncertain world. The very camera which would explicate the internal state of the subject has no film in it." Indeed, her dissimilars take from what is familiar and musicalize it all. Well, perhaps not in a way that one could dance to, unless, that is, you are ready for a very unusual dance. That is, she references our state of living, the things that we have stuck in us. She recontextualizes to make them dear and or show how dear they are not, not when one considers the new classification. Of many of Monica's approach genres, Gertrude Stein might say, that has already been classified. But Monica reclassifies our world, and like many poets, but in a particular de la Torrean sort of way, she peculiarizes it. Admirably, Monica adds notes to the end of her recent book, Talk Shows, giving an appendix of influence. If you'd like to begin your own Monica de la Torre fan club workshop series, take a look at the last few pages of Talk Shows and try to revisualize them into your very own lesson in radical contemporary poetry. Please welcome Monica de la Torre.
It's called $6.82. My economy is circular. I earn money from an institution that owns most of the businesses where I tend to spend most of my money. My economy is quasi-medieval, trade-centered and guild-like. My economy is not arch-canonical. My economy is a misfortune that recently befell me. My economy admits foundational narratives. My economy is language. My economy is the executioner's reversal of fortune. My economy has no essential features. My economy admits parallax critiques of ideology. My economy owes something to over 3,000 dead soldiers. My economy does not intimate and would rather not split hairs about what belongs to whom. My economy can't stay out of things, but it can't make it into the thick of things either. My economy has questionable purchasing power. My economy has no surrogate. My economy has no interpretive skills, but is rife with interpretive communities. My economy is like trees chopped down in Brooklyn and the gradual encircling of brick. My economy is a new red. My economy thrives on shades of gray. My economy is an unremarkable tuna sandwich that is missing the slices of tomato I had asked for. My economy is a liter bottle of Poland spring water coming not from Poland, but from Maine, and bought at a university cafeteria in uptown Manhattan, where there are quite a number of water fountains that deliver water with a funky metallic aftertaste. My economy is a poem called First Purchase of the Month, consisting of two stanzas with 6 8-word lines, each within a larger poem that could be endless, but won't be. Could have been an outfit for the Whitney Biennial. Couldn't afford one, nor did I need it. Who cares about how you look at the zoo? It's about the animals, stupid. Which reminds me, could have been the trail mix I snacked on, and which I managed not to purchase myself. It was tuna on whole wheat, lettuce, jalapenos, a 1 liter bottle of water, colon spring. Asked for tomato too, which the lady forgot. You Puerto Rican, she asked. Don't think so, said the other one in Spanish. Let me answer. No, what made you think so? The peppers? My economy needs contractions and abbreviations. My economy is not fixed. My economy is broken, mispronounced. My economy has cold feet, even if there are plenty of socks at home. My economy would like to be wholesome and sound. My economy is a gift certificate that is not enough for what I'd like to have, so I end up spending money at a store that I dislike in the first place and will never visit again. My economy is a business lunch where I end up paying the bill instead of the person who'd like me to work with her. My economy consists of performing tasks for which I receive no quantifiable pay. My economy grows when it's enough to buy someone else a drink or a meal. My economy does not allow me to say no. My economy pretends to be booming, but instead is shaky and imploding. It doesn't matter because my economy is predicated on virtue, and it posits that it's purer than yours. My economy has no exchange value. I'd like to think of my economy as one of resistance and tactical difference. My economy is not a disposable good. There are no surpluses in my economy. I already owe what I just wrote. My economy is derivative, parasitical, and residual. My economy is a hand-me-down. My economy is not environmentally friendly, although it's not ravaging non-renewable resources either. My economy does not force me to put my money where my mouth is. Were I to pay for what I say, it would be a different story. 1 cent a word is not fair trade. My economy mistakes what it means to trade in futures. In theory, my economy is not the result of deliberate choice. It is makeshift and a tag-along. My economy has double standards. My economy has attention deficit disorder. My economy is a symptom of an incurable disease. My economy is not even mine. Word count, 682 words. Okay. I will read you some poems in talk shows, just a couple. This one is called On Translation. It's a whole different wavelength. Not to search for meaning, but to reenact a gesture, an intent. As a translator, one grows attached to originals. Seldom are choices so purposeful. At midday, the translator meets with the poet at a cafe at the intersection where for decades, streetwalkers and crossdressers have lined up at night for passersby to peruse. Not a monologue, but an implied conversation. The translator's response is delayed. The translator asks, the poet answers unrestrictedly. Someone watches the hand movements that punctuate the flow of an incomprehensible dialogue. You're speaking about the poet's disillusionment with void. One after another, vivid descriptions of the poet's dreams begin to pour out of his mouth. There's no signal of irony in his voice, nor a hint of astonishment, nor a suggestion of hidden meanings, rather a belief in the detritus theory. Se me aparece un gato fosforescente. Lo sostengo en mis brazos, sabiendo que no volveré a ser el mismo. Estoy en una fiesta. De pronto veo que el diablo está sentado frente a mí. Viste de negro, lleva una barba puntiaguda y un tridente en la mano izquierda. Es tan amable que nadie se da cuenta de que no es un invitado como los otros. Anuncian en la radio que Octavio Paz leerá su poema más reciente. Vaca. Vaca. Vaca, 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 vaca. Entro a un laboratorio y percibo aromas inusitados. Aún lo recuerdo. The translator knows that nothing the poet has ever said or written reveals as much about him as the expression on his face when he was asked to pose for a picture. He greets posterity with a devilish grin. To the translator's delight, he's forced to repeat the gesture at least 3 or 4 times. The camera has no film. The next poem I'm going to read is called Bankrupt Books, a collage. And what it is an antonymic translation. So I just took a list of titles in the bestseller list of the New York Times Sunday edition, and I took the titles and translated them into their opposites. So you might even recognize some of the titles here, and you know, these became not bestsellers but bankrupt books. Sister, an old trick. TV viewers think to themselves, the chain of skits, it's all concealed. The lion's hunter, who brought me milk? George, man of sleazy shoes, lazy bum, self-destructive loser. Beatles of a sinking moon, from the beginning of times, the potato generation. The liberator of Azkaban, Bridget Jones, stupidity's limit. Talk shows, days after days of oblivion, the stories of a death penalty administrator. Ridiculous accounts of beguiling idiocy. Where they don't belong, Mediterranean sun, orange trees, ocean, the art of dullness, Sundays on a couch. A retrograde rock star, the celebrity speaks, feeding on refuse for optimum decay. Decomposing body, decrepit mind, sabotage monogamy. Stars, an evaluation of self-hate. Have an awful time, Beowulf. Okay, and I'm gonna end with a series of poems. I'm not gonna read them all. In fact, I was inspired to write the first poem of the series when I was at Naropa 2 years ago. And it had to do with a tutorial where we were instructed not to make our peas pop. And I just realized that no matter what would happen with the tutorial, everybody made their peas pop. And so I thought, maybe I'll use that for a poem. And it became a poem about illegal immigrants and vigilantes hunting them down when they were crossing the border. I will not read that now, but the series is called Imperfect Utterances. And it is dedicated to all those public speakers who make unintended noises during their mic readings, performances, and speeches. And to all those private speakers who strive to speak fluently about matters that resist articulation. So hopefully my S's will hiss. Sibilant sibils. Summer is the sibil's favorite season. In the sizzling heat of the Texan summer, the actions of a soul woman start a chain reaction. While the president's on break, his popularity index sinks. He's the piss people begin to grasp. Her name is Cindy Sheehan, not Ma, and she ain't no Lenny Skutnik. Shh, silence. The bubble might soon burst, although they'll try to distract you with private issues posing as matters of the public's concern. A constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, abortion, and silly discussions about whether evolution is unsound, and you commit sin if you believe that babies go to limbo, they pass away unchristened. She says, if you hear me hiss, mind it not. It's the snakes, the sharks. In the sizzling heat of a southern summer, another sibyl who foresees a sinking comes whirling. Katrina is her name. She spreads the news, leaves no room for doubt. While the president's on break, his popularity index sinks. He's the pits people begin to grasp. Sibyls thrive on scandals. There's no such thing as national security. If there's no such thing as national security, then there's no such thing as personal security. So long, safety. So long, illusion. So long, solipsism. May New Orleans rise while he keeps sinking. May all of his cronies sink, along with those who systematically avoid the other sides of things. The one that never looks good in the picture, like the boots of every dead soldier. May the drone of the planes that didn't get to New Orleans on time and the spreading stink of oil and toxic substances pop the bubble. Silence. Listen to them speak about their uselessly dead offspring. Sorry, Cindy Sheehan ain't no Lenny Skutnik, and you won't find none in the Gulf Coast region either. Don't miss the summer's heroes and coming attractions. Applause. And the next poem is called Cease to Stutter, Sing Song. I tend to stutter sometimes. So this poem is in Spanish. And this is part of the series, but I've been trying to write poems in Spanish that American audiences will understand. So this makes sense. Believe me. If you want a translation, you can come see me after the end, after the reading. Cease to stutter, sing-song. No, no, si, no. No, no, si, no, si. No, si, si, no. No, si, si, no, no. Si, no, si, no. Si, no, si, no, no. Si, si, no. Si, no, si. Si, no, no. Si, no. No, si. Si, no, no, no. Si, no, no, si. Si, no, 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 si. Si, no, 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 no. No, no. No. No, no, si. No, 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 si, no, no, no. No, si, no, si, no, si, no. Si, no. I hope I'm not going over. The last piece is called Monolingualism. And the sound. And it's all monosyllables. Ready? Monolingualism. Dar dos, dar tres, dar seis, dar diez, dar más, dar mal, mal par, mal par, dar más, dar sol, dar sal, ser par, sin par, ser rol, de sol a sol, ser rol, sin dos, sin tres, sin seis, sin diez, sin sal o mal, sin paz, ser mal, por dos, por ti, por mí, y yo, y tú, y él, ¿y quién más? ¿A quién? ¿Por qué? ¿De quién? ¿Con qué? El juez. ¿Me crees? ¿Qué ves? ¿Qué me ves? ¿Qué le ves? ¿Qué te ves? ¿La piel? Di piel, que cae del pez al mar. Di el mes de una vez, pon qué, di don, di dos. ¿Me crees? ¿Qué es? ¿Quién es? Se fue. Ya que. Thank you.
Pavla Yantsenova without first mentioning my own correspondence and meeting with her. I first began correspondence with Pavla via email via Lisa Berman about 2 years ago. Here are some tidbits of her correspondence to me. Dear Jen, I hear from Lisa Berman you are interested in Czech poetry, especially Vítězslav Nezval. I am a Nezval fan too, in spite of his problematic Stalinist history. What do you like best? Has the movie Valerie in her Week of Wonders made it over to the U.S.? Best, Pavla. P.S. Are you coming to study in Prague? And later, Eva Schmidt-Meyerova is my heroine. Her Bradley Cave is in English. The surrealist group around Analog magazine are pretty cool. Not too many women, but other than Eva Schmidt-Meyerova, there is a younger Katrina Penasova who speaks great English, been to Mexico, and is nice. I am just holding Vera Dumkova's recent poetry book in my hands. So much to translate. Let me know how you are progressing. I read you these letters to show some bit of Pavla's spirit, though you will soon see it for yourself when I am finished telling you just a bit more about her. Pavla Yantsenova is a recipient of a Fulbright research scholarship on the topic of women's rock lyric. In Prague, she teaches literary and alternative culture classes at Charles University in the Naropa Study Abroad program in Anglo-American University. Her publications include articles, interviews, translations, and poetry. She has even translated our very own Anne Waldman into Czech. She performs with an all-women's rock band, Zubi Nidi, who have produced 7 albums and a film for television. Naropa Study Abroad students have said of Pavla, "She is a marvelous teacher of great Czech hermeneutic, alchemical, and pataphysical variations. She is vibrant, someone you want to tap into the mind of, to research her brain, to access those many things, too numerous ever to all come out. Please help me welcome Pavla Yantsenova."
Thank you.
That was such a surprise. I've never heard such an introduction. So it was like a very difficult choice to find pieces that would fit the spirit of the place, that I would feel that would kind of resonate with you, that could please you and amuse you. And so let me start with a little warning poem about what happens if you read too much of Sappho. Girls from Athena's camp. Athena, you are the only one I adore. I left Artemis in the training fields years ago. So how come Aphrodite always kills all my plans and projects? She, with her sweet face, is so merciless, and I have not found any weapons yet to defeat her. Athena, I swear, you are the one I want to evoke every night, worship and assure you of my faithful service. Sure, the girls from Aphrodite's camp can't expect any Fulbrights coming their way. They don't. Why would they? They are so busy with love. And that is something that the leader of Athena's camp can never forgive. So the next piece is just a record of a sad event of the death of the guru of the underground movement of Egon Bondi, the philosopher and poet and lyricist for the band The Plastic People of the Universe. He died on 22nd April this year. And shortly after that, there was a commemoration concert of the Plastic People. And here I met with my old friend Martin Machovec, who is this dedicated editor of underground poetry. And he basically keeps the scene documented perfectly. And Martin was sitting in the club with a pint of beer, and he exclaimed when he saw me, "The cardinal, the highest priest of Bohemia, ordered, covered the whole lesser town of Prague with black cloth to mourn the death of the left Marxist, Egon Bondi, the pearl among the Czechs. I, the highest priest of the tribe, myself will celebrate the Requiem Mass in the Cathedral of St. Vitus for the faithless Egon Bondi, just because he was the best of us." Martin Machovec was getting all prophetic, stretching his arms out in the gesture of Princess Lubusa. And that kind of thing happens to any member of the Czech underground after their fifth beer, especially if these are accompanied with shots of Fernet. We sat down at a table in the hall of Club Delta. Behind the wall, the opening band was playing. "The beer is not very good here," Martin remarked, downing his pint and opening a large file of obituaries. "Would you believe it, this Reje, this guy must have the patent for non-forgiveness." I glance over to the paper. "Good riddance to the pitiful traitor, Narc, informing on his best friends. It is better if all truth would be dug out rather than having these myths flying about. They sure must be darker than the truth," we agreed with Martin. "All these strangest double agents, Havel, Jim Chert, Bondi, Can we ever understand? Ivan Bieranzel, the plastic people, double bass and cello player, was walking past us. Martin, you were Egon Bondes' adopted child like us, weren't you? We will do a special Bond memorial tonight. Speak only good about the dead, continued Martin. Didn't Bondi had enough in his last years being total hell? And imagine, it is exactly 13 years to the day when his lady, Julie, died. His daughter-in-law would take care of him, his last angel, and he begged her, bring me cyanide, don't leave me like this, bring me cyanide. And Bondi, with his insomnia, this is what that song, Lucky You to Be Asleep, is about. This is when what he was saying to Julie. He could only sleep a little bit on heavy pills. In the end, it got so bad that he was on downers all the time. He lit up his cigarette, fell asleep, and got a 45% body burn. They rushed him to hospital and kept him in morphine sleep for 3 weeks. But then it was time for Bondi to go. Then, just before I left for Naropa, there was an urn placement at cemetery in Prague, and Martin was the master of the ceremony. And Egon Bondi's adopted band, the Plastic People, played unplugged Bondi's songs under the tree canopy of the ancient Malvazinka cemetery. Martin read Bondi's poems about poet's task to balance out the Holocaust and all suffering. Then he got all dreamy in memories. Once, Bondi was walking on the street under blossoming acacias, and he remarked, it seems as if we were just walking now under blossoming acacias, right? At that moment, it dawned on me that Bondi revolutionary abolished metaphor as a relict of the past. Then I had to leave the cemetery and I headed towards Ruzyně Airport. Flying over the stunning vast ice wasteland of Greenland, I heard Egon Bondi's high voice in my head. Look, it is as if we were just flying over Greenland. The next one is called Annunciation in Santa Fe. This is from my Fulbright year, July 1998, Santa Fe. Staying the night at Francis Tarbet's, who is on a mission from God. He has no time for trifles, like to ask us who we are. He has to transmit his mission. After an hour, it was like a solo concert for human voice. Perfect meditation moment. Some rags of his words reach up to me. Differences among religions are just for idiots. It is the same as if a Russian, an American, and French physicists meet. I started to listen attentively. Of course, I am also on a mission, but nobody knows as yet. Earlier that day, downtown Santa Fe Gallery, I saw a picture of the angel talking to Mary. That look on her face, she was scared to death. And then I closed my eyes. I'm floating in red sea. I'm looking up at red sky. And then a flag appears, a sign, a laughing dolphin. While on a different level, I heard Francis's sermon, his solo performance. You have to go to schools, you have to pay taxes, my parents told me. But to me, it didn't seem to be enough, because I want to focus all the compassion of the world in myself and to smile also. The concert has been going on for a couple of hours. The soloist just got so immersed into it that the dill sauce that we had cooked for him had gone completely cold. Soon it will come. We are waiting for the annunciation. And so I close my eyes, and suddenly there's fairies dancing around me. They're hugging me joyfully in congratulation, singing that I am blessed among women. I felt honored, and I thought, they might be right. It might be okay with that kind of support. And I was thinking, what kind of revelation, what kind of proofs our host, Francis, the Francis of Santa Fe, has that he wants to save the hobbies, and why they couldn't care less. And then I told myself, simply, we just wish to experience it once, that real, real annunciation in Santa Fe. We thought that that's the best instrument in the world. So it's just a very simple little poem with two bass guitars.
hedge coat is many. Is Wendat, Metis, Salagi, Creek, French Canadian, Portuguese, Irish, Scot, English. She is and has lived many lives. Tobacco sharecropper, pool hustler, short-lived, factory worker, fisherwoman, mother, teacher of poetry, literature, native studies, arts curator, state government activist for indigenous rights and needs, homeless and low-income housing advocate, mentor to incarcerated youth. She grew up in North Carolina, Canada, and on the Great Plains. She is an original fellow of the Black Earth Institute think tank. She is a poet and writer, author of Dog Road Woman, a collection of poems from Coffee House Press, a memoir, Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer, a story of survival, published as a bison book from University of Nebraska Press, a collection of labor-related poems, Off-Season City Pipe from Coffee House, 2005, a verse play, Blood Run, published this year by the British Salt Press as part of their Earthworks series, based on her seven-year effort lobbying the state of South Dakota to acquisition and protect Blood Run, a large Native mound site area inhabited 8,500 years and recently quarried for roadfill. She finally won over officials of the Game, Fish, and Parks Department by her reading of a five-page poem, at the end of which they voted unanimously to acquire Blood Run as a protected site. Along with Sherwin Bitsui, also on this week's faculty and others, she is working with indigenous South and Central American poets in a vision of reunification. She has spoken at the United Nations on this behalf, as well as a spokesperson for the women's peacekeeping movement. She has just edited the first inclusive Western Hemisphere anthology of indigenous poetry, Ahani, published this year from Oregon State University Press. She is about to assume the Reynolds Chair of Poetry at the University of Nebraska, Kearney. I'd like to read from Allison's dedication to Off-Season City Pipe, because of it struck me after hearing today's panel how how well this addresses certain kinds of experiential layers of border crossings. This book is dedicated to workers in manual arts, to those that follow the work to survive, to those who lost tribal status and gained union cards, to Shanghaied people forced to labor, to those that love the land, to those who belong to a land far away from foot, to peoples in the aftermath of diaspora, to the descendants of survivors in the long walk to Indian territory, to all those who did not survive, to those who remained in hiding, to those relocated and dislocated peoples finding solace in nomadic travels and kinship, in unraveling the commonality of human experience and the frailty of human existence, in passion, in loss, and in yearning, this book is my prayer for you. Please welcome the many Allison Hedge Cook.
Ago, before bulk barns and fifth gear diesel tractors, we rode royal blue tractors with toolboxes, a six-pack on ice. In the 115-degree summer, heat with air so thick with moisture you drink as you breathe before the year duster sprayed malathion over our clustered bodies, perspiring while we primed the bottom lugs, those ground-level leaves of tobacco, and it clung to us with the black tar so sticky we rolled 8-inch balls off our arms at night and Cloroxed our clothes for hours and hours before we were poisoned And the hospital thought we had been burned in fires at least to the third degree, when the raw oozing hives that covered 98% of our bodies from the sprays ordered by the FDA and spread by the landowners, before anyone had seen the automated machines at top and prime. We topped the lavender blooms of many tiny flowers. That's very bizarre. Okay, I'm going to pick it up from there. It's very bizarre to me. Okay. We topped the lavender blooms of many tiny flowers gathered into one, gorgeous, by grasping hold below the petals with our bare calloused hands and twisting downward quick, hard, only one time, snapped them off. Before edgers and herbicides took what they call weeds, we walked for days through 30 acres and chopped them out with hoes. Hoes made long before from wood and steel, and sometimes even longer ago from wood and deer scapula. Before the bulk primers came, we primed all the leaves by hand, stooped over at the waist for the lower ones, and through the season we gradually rose higher until we stood and worked simultaneously, as married to the fields as we were to each other. Carrying up to 50 pounds of fresh leaves under each of our arms and sewing them onto sticks 4 foot long on a looper under the shade of a tin roof barn made of shingle, and poked it up to the rafters inside to be caught by a hanger, who poked it up higher in the rafters to another who held an even higher position, and so they filled the barn. And the leaves hung down like butterfly wings, though sometimes the color of Luna moths or Carolina parakeets, when just an hour ago they had been laid upon an old woman cart trailer pulled behind an orange Alice Chandler tractor with huge round fenders and only a screwdriver and salt in the toolbox. These were picked by primers so hot we would race through the rows to reach the 25-gallon jugs of water placed throughout the field to encourage and an attempt to satisfy our insatiable thirst from drinking air which poured through our pores without breaking through to our need for more water in the sun. Some we imagined to disappear and yet respected for growing all things on earth, when quenched with rains called forth by our songs and drumming, leaves which weeks later would be taken down, and the strings pulled like string on top of a large dog food bag and sheeted up into burlap sheets that bundled over 100 pounds that we smashed with our feet, but gently smashing and thrown up high to a catcher on a big clapboard trailer, pulled behind 2-ton trucks and taken to market in Fuquay, Verena, and sold to Philip Morris and Winston Salem for around a buck a pound. The leaves cured to a bright leaf, a golden yellow with the strongest aroma of the tobacco barn curing and hand-grown quality before the encroachment of big business in the Reagan era and the slow murder of method of 100 years before, when the loons cried out in laughter by the pond and the bass popped the surface early on next to the fields before that time when it was unfashionable to transplant each individual baby plant, the infant tobacco we nurtured, to transplant those seedlings to each hill in the field, the space for that particular plant, and we watched as they would grow. Before all of this new age, new way, I was a sharecropper in Willow Springs, North Carolina, as were you. And we were proud to be Jalagi, wishing for winter so we could make camp at Kuala Boundary and Oconalefti River would be free of tourists and filled up with snow. And those of us who held out forever would be home again with our people while the BIA forgot to watch. And we still remember before even Europeans, working now shoulder to shoulder with their descendants of the slaves that they brought from Africa, when they sold our ancestors as slaves into the Middle East, that then the tobacco was sacred to all of us and we craved whenever we smoked and did not smoke for pleasure, and I was content and free. Then they came and changed things and you left me for a fancy whiter girl, and I waited on the land until you brought her back in that brand new white Trans Am purchased from our crop you gave her and left her waiting in a motel. The nearest one was 40 miles away, but near enough for you and for her. And I knew, though I never spoke a word to you about it, I knew. And I kept it to myself until this day and time, and I never let on until I left on our anniversary. I drove the pickup down the dirt path by empty fields and rented a shack for $80, one with cardboard windows and a Gillespie house floor design, with torn and faded floral paper on walls and linoleum so thin over the rotted board that the floor gave if you weighed over 100 pounds, and I did not, with no running water of any kind nor bathroom, the one at Hilltop where I could see out across all the fields and hunt for meat when I wanted and find peace. And I heard you remarried and kept up with America. And I watched all of you from the hill. And I waited for the lavender blooms to return, and when it was spring, even the blooms had turned white. And I rolled up my bedroll, remembering before, when our fields were like waves on a green ocean, and turned away from the change and corruption of big business on small farms and of traditional agricultural people and sharecroppers, away so I could always hold this concise image of before that time, and it floods my memory. Self-immolation. His Levi's laced with gasoline, so thick wet legs became funnels, no wicks in a holocaust, skin turned to hard ash. Roll me in a blanket, screams from our burning board floor, the windows blown off, doors blown off, the flames were blowing. Roll me in a blanket. I threw one to my dad. We smothered my brother's charred legs, smothered the entire room, walls, doors, window frames, bed and bike, a dirt bike, a 175 Yamaha. He was cleaning it with gas and stealing one of my smokes, a Winston filter. I peeled his pants and the meat came down with the denim. We placed him in ice water, the bones exposed, his muscles barely hanging. The only time he ever said to me, "I love you. I'm sorry for all the things I've done." And I believe it now, 22 years later, the smoked Venetian blind shook in the wind like breastplates, scorched sticks swollen up like grapes full of blood, climbed our cheek paneling trying to escape. Like me, he tried to take his life. Like me, we both survived. And this is Walk Over Your World. A green-eyed mixed-blood 13-year-old NC boy holds up the Wachovia savings and loan with his plum-jam finger. The greenbacks flow from the teller to a brown paper sack and everybody else is face down with 360. He knows they're trembling, shaking like he does when our mama's lecturing the light bulb all through the night. They're quivering from pressure on points unknown, underdeveloped, and he knows it's all going smoothly. The two older boys guard posting the door, back out, duck, tuck for cover, run to catch the yellow and black Impala as he makes the block with three other Haines-faced boys. And soon they all lay sprawled out in a Motel 6, covered with U.S. currency, small bills and large, because they never were picky kids. The green-eyed boy who's stuffing his pockets full of swearing, "I ain't gonna work my ass off like my old man and be stuck in still toes like you. There's a foosball parlor in Virginia with my name written all over." And right outside, the county's finest is outlining clue shots on each figure fingering the dough, the sheriff softly singing in the sweet by and by. Valencia Street, Mission District. I can't edge out the eyes, the hollow coffins blinded. Can't edge out the steel needles, maybe Cloroxed, maybe not. Scraped on matchbooks, finally honed as if sharpening stones. I can't dodge that heat rush, the blood and boil in my elbow pits, my memory banks, the memory of retching. But it's not me this time. Still a silver sliver spike spies on me. Like a periscope, its code name blues. Persistent from another time, a measure metronome, touching time, and time touches me the way a latex glove taps his brown cheek. The patrolman pushes a slightly turning Aztec angled jaw, and I'm remembering my own jaw, cop slapped decades back. Poor guy, I'll mutter to myself. All the while, I'm walking my today's ways, teaching dignity, working poetry into the chemical dependency programs, juvenile facility, literary addiction, and man, I just want to see him rise. Just stand up,
Poor guy, I'm looking back. Poor guy, I do need him to rise. I really need him to stand, regain his Houdini mentality, to stand. Get up on your feet now. Rise, take your stand there. Fly this time, let it fly. Let it fly, let it sail. Hoppin' Dickskin. The desire so strong, your steps quicken back to the house. You don't even want to peel it. You grab a big butcher knife over the breadboard and you slice it in half like a grapefruit, each section firm and bright. A sugar spoon lifts the first bite, separating pulp and thick skin, and with distaste is knowledge. Heading out back through rain-soaked grass, brown mud, the orange trees drenched bloom again, little white blooms almost like honeysuckles with the thickness of lilies. Freshly clustered amid the grove green leaves, leaves so thick they split when you fold them double. The orange trees filled with blooms and green fruit when just last week you could stand a field away and witness the ripening. Everything so wet and cool, the ground gives with each step. The grass is plastering my canvas shoe, and if you walk around the tree slowly enough, looking deep into the hidden limbs, the huge round fruit is ready to squeeze to be devoured, and it hangs steadily inviting your plucks. Your arm slides in the wet, wet tree, rain still alive within the branch, covering your arm and hand, splashing you with morning. Your arm glides in and picks the nearest one, stealing fresh Christmas for the table. And if you grew up like me, you find yourself back in time, picking fruit in the fields. Do you remember? Waking to pick each morning in the wet groves, the sacks on our waist and shoulders, the crates, the 5-gallon buckets below, filling the huge crates stacked in rows and trucked off to Minute Maid or Sun-Kissed. But right now it's the taste you need, the wet, sweet, sour citrus. This is a Sherwin. This is for you. This is Sorrel Run. Sorrel red and built to tamp devils into dust, her withers keen, the strong mare, she challenges northers. She winds her quarter turn on a dime and stands full-breasted, trigger flexed, her hinds the shape of running. Her back feathers of deer fly, it whacks the heavy air as if it were something permeable, and my hands toss the saddle, cinch down and pull me up, 16 hands leg over and stirrup. The legs are loose as if this were still the first day on a green break lunge line. As soon as we head out, riding open, past the thistle and gate, she catches a gait of her own, a strong throb of beat, deep and drumming. My hair is whipping like a frayed flag, and all I see is the cliff edge, and her ears tilting back. All I feel is her life spark charging full center forward, and all I know is we have about 5 flat minutes on this red runaway until it's us flying out, and she is determined. Turn her down, bite her ear, wind her down, I hear a voice say inside me. Turn her down. My hands grip both reins and pull down, leaning all the way on her right like a trick ride at midpoint rodeo. I tug the leather down to my ankle, reach up, bite her ear, tug and hold and pray once loud enough for my prayers to carry from my mind to the dog road to Capella and Auriga or Deneb in Cygnus, and she swoops, neck over and circles tight. Winds, pivots into that particular dime turn, and everything turns red as when you close your eyes in the sun and everything is swirling. We're bent double, both of us. We're one in the most unfavorable fashion. Rider and horse, yes, but one and the same. And for years they said she'd never cut loose or pulled her runaway again. But I did. I still am. Somewhere in the circle we traded. I saved her, and she blessed me. She makes a great ride now. And I carry out all her plans for escape. Thank you.